and this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Last year, three Cincinnati City Council members were indicted on federal bribery charges, leading many to believe there might be a culture of corruption at City Hall. But what leads a person to cheat? Cincinnati Edition continues our coverage, Trust in Local Government, WVXU's Public Integrity Project. With so many members of council allegedly gaming the system, is corruption contagious? Duke University researcher Dan Ariely says corruption spreads like the plague. He's conducted experiments into corruption using a virtual dice that students throw in return for a reward. The experiment created a moral dilemma in which students had an incentive to lie. And Duke University James B. Duke, professor of psychology and behavioral economics and Center for Advanced Hindsight founding member Dan Ariely joins us now. Professor Ariely, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Just one clarification. These experiments were not just done on students. They were done on lots and lots of people, also on students. And it's not that we find that students cheat and other people don't. It's kind of a general human tendency.
Well, we appreciate that clarification, and we're going to talk more about your research right now. I hear the word contagious, and I'm reminded that over the past 15 months, we've all learned a lot about contagions. But I'm imagining that you're not suggesting politicians, when elected, start wearing face masks at City Hall. I mean, there's something deeper to it than respiratory spread, no?
Yes, no, very, very different. But in some sense, maybe more dangerous, because you can get it from watching other people. And the basic principle is that our actions are not dictated so much of what is written in the law book, but it's framed, and we think about it in the sense of what do we see around us. So if you see around you many people litter, and if you see around you many people speeding, then we think differently about this. And I'll describe to you an experiment we did. So you describe it in the beginning, kind of, you know, we gave people a die. In this case, it was a physical die. And we say, why don't you toss the die? If it comes on six, we'll give you $6, five, you'll get $5, four, four, and so on. But you can get paid based on the top side or the bottom side. You decide, but don't tell us. Don't tell us until after you throw. So imagine you were in the experiment. I would give you a die. I would say, think top or bottom. You thought about it, decided. Yes, keep it in your mind. Don't tell me. And now please toss the die. And let's say you tossed the die. And let's say it came with five on the bottom and two on the top. And now I say, okay, what did you pick? Now, if you picked bottom, you say bottom, no problem. You get $5. If you pick top, you have a dilemma. Do you say the truth, top, and get paid $2, or do you change your mind after the fact and say, no, I really thought bottom? And the basic result we get with this experiment is that lots of people lie a little bit. We've ran this on more than 30,000 people. We found that very, very few people are big cheaters, but we have a ton of little cheaters.
Well, I wonder.
So that's part one.
Well, but before you go into part two, was there any type of variance when the stakes are considered?
Yes. So when the stakes go really high, people stop cheating.
Interesting.
And the reason is that what we find is that cheating is not really about cost-benefit analysis. Cheating is not about, you know, what do I stand to gain? What do I stand to lose? How much time will I get in prison? Cheating is really about how comfortable do I feel with this? And when the amount of money is small, people feel comfortable with this. And then when the amount of money is big, people actually stop and ask themselves. Like, you know, think about, you know, you would probably feel okay taking a toothpick from a restaurant home. You would probably not feel comfortable taking the cutlery home. And, you know, the cutlery is worth more, right? You should be more incentivized to do that. But it feels like a big step. So it's, you know, that's just cruel. It's just immoral. Taking a toothpick is fine. Right? So it turns out that we're better at small cheating than big. Better. We do it more frequently because we don't think of ourselves as big cheaters. But let's go to corruption for a second.
Sure, please. Go right ahead.
So we did this experiment, but we made a variation, and we described to the experiment to people like I described to you now with a die. But we said, look, but there are two versions of this experiment, one in which the maximum you can make today is $4. The exchange rate between dots to dollars was such that the most you can make today is $4. Another one, the most you can make is $40. And we said, please toss a coin. And we'll see if you got the $4 version or the $40 version. So people flipped the coin, and no matter what they flipped, we said, oh, sorry, you got the $4 version. But now comes the kicker. The research assistant looked around and said, listen, my boss is not here today, so I'll tell you what. If you will give me $3, the $3 you got to show up, the $3 you got to pay for the transportation for the bus, I will say you got the $40 version. I'll say you got the other coin flip, and you'll move from the $4 version to the $40 version. So now the research assistant is asking him for a bribe. And the first question I ask you about your intuition about psychology, what percentage of people do you think bribed him?
You're asking me to guess?
Yeah.
Oh, man. 30%.
Okay. So slightly more than 90. Slightly more than 90.
Oh my gosh.
But just to realize, I run around the world doing experiments and with suitcases, with money and so on. Nobody ever came to me and asked me if I want to be bribed. This was an experiment in which the research assistant, the person in charge of the experiment, said, I'm interested in the bribe. Right? So they came to an environment, and what was clear that corruption is fine in that environment, and that's the contagion part. Now, after that, what happened to their cheating? Did they cheat more, less, or the same? They cheated much more. So not only did they move from $4 to making maximum $4 to maximum moving $40, but they also cheated more. But there's one more interesting element. They kept a sheet of paper, and they said the die came on 5 on the bottom, 2 on the top. I chose bottom. I deserve $5. It came on 6 and 1 and so on. And at the end, they had a little equation that said how much money they deserve. They threw the die 20 times, and they summed the numbers, and they said how much we owe them. But then instead of paying them, let's say somebody calculated that we owe them $23. Instead of paying them $23, we gave them an envelope. And we said, here's an envelope with $50. Pay yourself the amount of money you deserve. The amount of money you don't deserve, leave in the envelope. And when you leave the room, there's a big box with envelopes. Drop it there. So people could cheat twice. They could cheat once by saying, oh, I really meant bottom, I really meant top when they threw the dice. But they could also write $23 and take 30 or 40 or even 50. In general, we find that people cheat but don't steal. Okay. We find that people lie about the die, how it fell, what they chose in advance. But once they write $23 on a form, they take $23. But this experiment, the one with the corruption, the one where the research assistant said, hey, I accept the bribe, was the first time we also found that people were also stealing. And that for me is kind of the two sides of this. The first one is that when we see the person in charge of a system acting in a corrupt way, we are very likely to after one encounter, change our own morality and start acting in a corrupt way as well. And then the second thing is, it's not just that we cheat more, that we start stealing as well. For me, the move from cheating to stealing is a move along the immorality scale, quite a big move from just saying, oh, I really meant bottom, I really meant top, to saying, I said $23, but I'm taking really 40. So that's the basic story. But there's one more kind of interesting element to it, which I think is important for understanding politicians. We ran this experiment also in a different way. Sometimes we had couples, and sometimes people ran it by themselves. They just sat in front of the sheet of paper and with a die, and they did it. And sometimes the significant other was sitting next to them. Now, the significant other didn't know what's in their heads. Am I thinking heads or tails? But they could see whether people were, extra lucky and most likely cheating. And what do you think happened? Again, I'm asking you to guess. What do you think happened when people were sitting next to their significant other? Did they cheat more or less?
You see, now you've got me skewing towards people being bad. So I think they cheat more.
They do cheat more. And why do they cheat more? And why do they cheat more? In a different experiment, we'll come back to this in a second. I'm just finishing. In a different experiment, we got people to cheat when we connected them to a lie detector. And what we found is that when people were cheating for themselves, the lie detector worked. It predicted when they were lying. But when people picked their favorite charity and all the money that they were making today was going to go to that charity, the lie detector stopped working. So when people were lying for a charity, they cheated more and the lie detector stopped working. Why? Because when we cheat for other people, we feel altruistic. And the lie detector detects a tension between I want more money, but I think it's bad. But the moment it's for a good cause, we don't feel bad about it. Now, going back to sitting next to your significant other, I think that the moment we feel that we cheat for the whole family, we don't feel as bad about it. And I suspect this is what happens to politicians, is that they can very easily frame it to themselves as if their dishonesty is not for them, it's for the good of the nation, the good of the town, the good of the city. There's all kinds of ways to reframe it. I'm not saying it's reality, but they can think of themselves, and that can further liberate them from the moral shackles.
We're talking today with Professor Dan Ariely. He's with Duke University, where he is the James B. Duke Professor of Psychology and Behavioral Economics, also founding member of the Center for Advanced Hindsight, has done detailed research on the effect of one bad apple on the barrel, for example. And we explore this in the context of multiple members of Cincinnati City Council being indicted on federal bribery charges last year. I'm wondering if there is a Robin Hood effect then. I mean, that seems to be what you're implying here. If you're, you know, stealing for reasons that are good, even if it is against the law, against the rules, you can support your claim to being able to do it.
That's right. And it doesn't have to be pure Robin Hood, but it could be partial Robin Hood. Like, imagine we connected Robin Hood to a lie detector when he was robbing the rich. Do you think he would have felt bad? No. He felt he was doing the right thing. And I think the same thing can happen to anybody who can frame their action as being for the public good. So imagine that I do something that is partially for me and partially for the public good, or at least I can frame myself as doing that. That would liberate people from their moral shackles. Because again, we don't make decisions about what's legal and not legal. And most of the things, we don't even know what's legal and not legal. We make decisions based in terms of what fits with our moral reasoning at the moment and what makes us feel queasy. So, and you know, this is why, for example, people have an easy time taking a pencil from work, but we can't take 25 cents from petty cash box. The things that make us clear that we are, this makes us uneasy morally, and the things that are easy for us to do. Rationalization is really the issue here. And if somebody takes a bribe, but they can rationalize it as if it's at the public interest inherently, they can justify to themselves and be more likely to do it.
I want to note that the three individuals who were indicted on Cincinnati City Council, two of them are fighting their charges, of course. Currently, one of them has been sentenced to prison after pleading guilty. They are all separate cases. There are some commonalities in theme and in two of the cases, personalities, but the cases are all different. I note, Professor Ariely, you said, basically, I'm summing this up in layman's terms, that the person in charge can kind of set the example for how people engage in corruptible behavior. And I'm wondering if you can explain in the context of a local government how that might play out. Is there a figure, or is it a group effort to set a standard for how people are expected to behave in this regard?
Absolutely. So it can be from the person at the top, right? The mayor, but it can also be from peers. And if we see other people behaving in certain ways, it's very easy to basically float down in the same direction. Again, we take a lot of lessons from the people around us, not in a conscious way, but this is what dictates the norms. If people around you start speeding on the highway, you know, you'll start speeding as well. If you're in an online dating app and people start exaggerating their, you know, reducing their age by 2 or 3 years and their pounds by 3 or 4 pounds, over time, that will be the new norm. You will not feel that you're relying on this. We did a study when we put people in the magnet, in an fMRI, and we looked at their brains. And what we saw is that when people start lying, their brains, their emotional parts of the brain are as if they're protesting. They're saying, hey, something is going on here. But after a while, these voices in our head get quiet. Like, think about the last time you blamed traffic. I don't know how traffic is in Cincinnati, but think about the last time you blamed traffic for being late for something. You know, probably the first time you did it, you felt really bad about doing it. But the last time you did it, you probably didn't feel any remorse. You didn't even think of it as lying. We just got used to blaming traffic for being late for a meeting or something. So we get used to things. We take guidance from the people around us. We take guidance from the person, the head of our organization. And once we start acting in a certain way, we get used to that way and we stop thinking about it.
I can assure you, Professor Ariely, Cincinnati traffic is atrocious. So it's always a go-to excuse for a lot of us, although it can't be used as an excuse, I suppose, when you're facing federal bribery charges. Yeah. I do want to ask, and we've got a few minutes together still, what did you notice just in your previous work or general observations that made you want to dive into this, I guess, bad apple thesis?
So that my first observation was a case where I cheated myself. I was on a flight and I had one of these Mensa tests. You know, these things like you go on the flight magazine and on page 132, you have a question and on page 235, you have the answer. And I looked at question one and I looked at the answer and I got it right. But I went back. But what I noticed is that when I was looking at the answers, I kind of glanced at the next answer. And of course, then I went back to the question. I proved to myself that I was smart, right? But I was cheating myself. And I started thinking that, you know, we have this model of cheating for other people, that we do a cost-benefit analysis. And here I was saying I wanted to prove myself that I was intelligent and I kind of proved to myself. And then this was around the time when Enron was going on. And I thought, you know, Are the people in Enron, how did it really work? Was it really just a few bad apples or were a lot of people fooling themselves because they were motivated to do so? So that's where basically started, a little bit of self-deception, a little bit of Enron, and that got me going down that. And I've been doing this research for a long time. Of course, since Trump went for election, the research on dishonesty became even more interesting.
Right. I mean, the previous president was noted for outrageous lies in public, but never really acknowledging that they were not truthful, which was very interesting to show that there can be success in politics, even when you are openly deceitful about what you're saying. I'm going to take a phone call. We did get a call. If you don't mind, I'm going to turn over to the phones where you find Garrett on the line. Hi, Garrett. What's your question or comment?
Hi there. I first just want to say that I am a huge fan of both Dr. Ariely and Cincinnati City Council. You're like one of my top five favorite people in the world, Doctor. So thanks for coming on to Cincinnati Edition today.
We appreciate that, Garrett.
So I wonder, it seems that most corruption in politics is based on getting reelection money in ways that are unscrupulous. If there was no re-election, I wonder if corruption would go down. So if we set up our system to just have everybody run for one term, if that would lower corruption.
Garrett, thank you for the very interesting question. We appreciate that. We'll hang up and let Dr. Ariely answer your question. Is that something you can address when you qualify the research? I guess this goes back to what we were talking about earlier, the stakes. If you're not tasked with running for re-election, if you don't have something to prove in that respect, does that limit the opportunity or the desire to be corrupted?
So very much so. So first of all, Garrett, thanks a lot for the compliment. I'll just say that, compliments really work. So it makes me very happy. So thank you very much. In terms of the comment, he's absolutely right. So one of the things, if you think about who are the villains in the world of dishonesty, I think the villains are conflicts of interest and rationalization. It's human nature. You know, you could say, oh, there are bad people and good people. The reality is that we all have the capacity to become quite worse people than we are now in certain circumstances. And conflicts of interest are terrible. You know, we all recognize conflicts of interest. Like if you think about a football game? I don't know, in Cincinnati, like, do you have a football team or something?
Oh, we certainly do. FC Cincinnati.
I'm joking. I'm
their stadium's right next to the studio.
So, you know, if you're on the
oh, wait, American football, game, the Bengals. See, I'm so confused now because what do I know? It's soccer season, isn't it? All right, go ahead. My apologies.
So if you think about sports, if a referee calls a call against your team, you know that you're biased. You know that you think the referee is evil, vile, stupid, something. We see the world through the perspective that we want to see it. Now, if you get paid a lot or you get a second term to see reality in a certain way, you are very likely to be able to see it this way. So the thing that we need to fight is conflicts of interest. And re-election creates terrible conflicts of interest. Now, here's the good thing and bad thing. Like, you know, when you think about how easily corrupted people are and how effective lobbyist is, it's terrible. On the other hand, if you think about it from a humanity perspective, it's really quite nice. Like the fact that you can buy me a sandwich and beer and all of a sudden I'll start seeing life from your perspective, that's wonderful in the social world, right? Because all of a sudden, I can buy your perspective. You buy me beer and you'll complain about your significant other and I'll see life from your perspective. It's very easy to get people to see life from our perspective. We've become their friends. You mix it with politics. You mix it with health. You mix it with financial. Now we have a real problem. So we need to look. And nobody sees how conflicts of interest work on them. Like none of us said, oh, yes, if somebody paid me money, I would change my worldview to be more in their perspective. But that's how it works. It works in a very deep way. It colors the worldview and we don't see it happening. And that's why politics and money are such a bad mix.
We've been talking with Dan Ariely, Duke University, James B. Duke Professor of Psychology and Behavioral Economics, also founding member of the Center for Advanced Hindsight. Professor Ariely, thank you so much for this fascinating conversation. I do hope that you'll carve out some time for us again sometime.
Anytime and with pleasure.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Bye-bye.
And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Our assistant producer is Nick Swartzel. Our technical director is Josh Elstro. Our theme music is composed by Rob Fetters. You can find archives of our program online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks. We'll talk again tomorrow.